The following program is a presentation of the Jewelry Exchange and Auction.
An estate sale, where gawking strangers wander through your house and haggle over your treasures. Or an auction, where your valuables are sold to the highest bidder, whatever the price may be. Choose the lesser of two evils in the great estate debate. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to In the Money, the show that answers the questions, what is it, what's it worth, and what do I do with it? I'm David Bluestein.
And I'm Adam Bluestein from the Jewelry Exchange and Auction in San Antonio.
We're here each Saturday morning at 7 o'clock to provide an insider's view on the world of jewelry, coins, antiques, collectibles, and much, much more. As owners and operators of the Jewelry Exchange and Auction, we're on the front line with a finger on the pulse of these markets every day, and as of right now, you have a friend in the business. Estate sale or auction, when it's time to liquidate an entire household full of merchandise, which do you choose? Today we're talking with Janet Weisenhunt, co-owner of Charlotte's Antiques, one of San Antonio's premier estate sale conductors, and representing the auction option, there's Adam and me from the Jewelry Exchange and Auction. Together we'll present the pros and cons of each technique, either of which is better than the third option, just putting everything into storage and paying that every month. We see people do that all the time, year after year. Anyone who listens to this show knows that we're proponents of flipping the merchandise, and however you do it, better than just storing it and paying for that privilege. Also on today's Insider Report, we're talking about silver dollars. America has a love affair with its silver dollars, and we want you to know which ones are truly collectible, which ones are worth only their silver value, and which ones you should spend as soon as possible before they lose even more of their buying power to inflation. We see people with a whole sock drawer full of that merchandise just becoming worth less and less each year. They should spend it as soon as they can. But before we dive into the meat, let's go to this week's In the Money trivia quiz, the quiz where you win the answer. Let's review last week's quiz first, and it was short and sweet. Bea Benaderet played George and Gracie's neighbor Blanche Morton on The Burns and Allen Show. She also played Jethro's mother on The Beverly Hillbillies. The question, what was the first and last names of her character on the show, The Beverly Hillbillies? You think, why in the world are they asking us that? Well, the answer, Pearl Bodine. Last week's show was all about pearls, pirates and pearls. We had Rudy Pena from Pena & Associates, who knows almost everything about pearls, but as it turns out, he didn't know the name of Jethro's mother. So he's not as smart as he thinks he is, right? But the answer, Pearl Bodine, Jethro Bodine's mother. And we had three winners, Andy Roth, Anthony Zara, and Juanita Perez. The prize, an 18-inch strand of white freshwater pearls with a sterling silver clasp. If you're a winner, if you're one of the three names that I just read, please come to the Jewelry Exchange and Auction on 19903 Stone Oak Parkway within the next 30 days to claim your prize. Our galleries open Monday through Saturday from 10 in the morning to 6 o'clock, and of course Saturday evenings during our live auction. For more information, just click the Contact Us tab on our website at www.jewelryexchangeandauction.com. And now for this week's quiz, it's another one that's really, really simple, short and simple. I'm a United States coin, and I'm mostly copper. I have a president on one side and a building on the other side. And during World War II, I was made of silver. What am I? To be a winner this week, all you have to do is to be one of the first three people to email the correct answer to quiz@inthemoneyradio.com. That's quiz@inthemoneyradio.com. You can also submit your answer directly from our homepage at www.inthemoneyradio.com. Then listen to next week's show to see if we read your name on the air. If we do, claim your prize at the Jewelry Exchange, 19903 Stone Oak Parkway, up in Stone Oak in San Antonio. You have 30 days to do that. You can enter as often as you like, but please, we ask only one winner per household per month. Please give everybody a chance. Remember, quiz@inthemoneyradio.com, quiz@inthemoneyradio.com. Meanwhile, Adam, what a week at the Jewelry Exchange, huh?
Yes. Yeah, so last week we sold a bunch of firearms. One was actually a new-in-the-box Winchester Model 94, a commemorative lever-action rifle with some beautiful engraving. That went for $850.
Yeah, the bidding was pretty fierce on that.
And we sold a Limoges, this is real Limoges, a porcelain china set, only $50.
Right.
Some of the other highlights, a certified 1890 Carson City U.S. Morgan dollar, graded MS-64 by PCGS, a silver dollar, $1,300. Another thing that we did was the, I always love it when we handle these, the 2006 three-piece U.S. proof, uncirculated, and it's the reverse proof American Silver Eagle set.
On proof coins, usually, the design itself is frosty, and the fields, the flat plain part is like a mirror, but on the reverse proof, just the other way around, frankly, looks stupid to me, but the U.S. Mint's looking for more and more ways to sell more and more coins, so why not a reverse proof?
But these actually bring some money. We've sold these for as much as over $1,000. This one, last week, $300. Some Roseville ceramic vases, as little as $10. Real pearl necklaces for as little as $25. Loose diamonds for as little as $80 a carat. And a lot of Tiffany, James Avery, Sulpata, Judith Ripka, up to 80% off retail.
You know, when you're getting calls from the James Avery company saying, hey, what are you guys doing? You know you're selling a lot of James Avery.
And this week, tonight, we are going to sell a bunch of new-in-the-box Disney porcelain figurines, cartoon cells. We've been called by Amanda's Gifts again. They were going out of business, and we thought we were finished with them, but they called us again. They said they got a lot more stuff, and so we're in for round two. I've got a bunch of key date cents and silver dollars, some Carson City Morgan dollars, a 1955 double die Lincoln cent, a lot of classic there's not really a lot of classic U.S. gold. I think we have one $20 St. Gaudens.
And did you mention the James Avery that we have tonight?
Well, not quite, not yet. I got some new tanzanite and ruby jewelry, a bunch of James Avery and Tiffany, a lot of designs I've never seen before, and I've handled an awful lot of pieces.
Yeah, we're seeing, and frankly, I've seen some designs I've seen before, but not that size. Some of it is just extraordinary.
Right. And we're going to take a short commercial break. We'll be back in just about 1 minute. Hi, this is Adam from the Jewelry Exchange and Auction in San Antonio, introducing our weekday James Avery auctions with 1,000 pieces of estate James Avery jewelry sold to the highest bidder with no minimums or reserves. New and retired designs at up to 80% off. This is a perfect opportunity to stock up on hard-to-find pieces. It's easy to register and bid online right now at jewelryexchangeandauction.com. Auctions start every Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday evening at 7 o'clock. Also join us each Saturday at 7 p.m. for our live auctions in Stone Oak, featuring even more designer jewelry from Rolex, Tiffany, Pandora, John Hardy, David Yurman, and more, all guaranteed to be authentic. It's all happening at the Jewelry Exchange and Auction. Texas license number 16604, member Better Business Bureau. Visit jewelryexchangeandauction.com and join us every Saturday morning at 7 a.m. for In the Money right here on KLUP. James Avery is a registered trademark of James Avery Craftsman Incorporated.
You're back with David and Adam Bluestein from the Jewelry Exchange and Auction on In the Money, the show that answers the questions, what is it, what's it worth, and what do I do with it? Today, for our Insider's Report, I want to talk a little bit about silver dollars, America's favorite coins. We spend a lot of time here on In the Money Radio talking about what's really not very valuable. And to really figure that out, you got to figure, well, is it a silver dollar or is it just a dollar? You know those Eisenhower dollars? They're the size of the old silver dollars, but unless it's in a blue envelope or a brown box, it's probably just a copper nickel dollar, not a silver dollar at all.
The easy way to tell is I always just turn it on the edge and look at the reeded edge, and if you can see that it's a copper nickel sandwich, if you can see the copper color, it's not silver.
Right, that ain't gold, folks. If it looks like copper in there, it's a copper nickel. It's dated 1971 through 1978. It's worth a dollar. Don't hang on to it and just spend around it. The little Susan B. Anthony dollars that look like quarters, minted from 1979 to 1981, they're just dollar coins. Please spend them. It didn't work, and yet Congress, in their wisdom, made them in 1999 for a short amount of time, and that didn't work either. And so they went to the Sacagawea dollar starting in 2000, which also did not work. So how about this in 2007? Let's go to the presidential dollars and the Sacagawea dollars. None of them work. And the Sacagawea dollars, the presidential dollars, you'll never think those are silver because they're obviously gold. In fact, they're called golden dollars, but it's not gold. It's manganese. If you think you can go to Walmart and get a gold coin in your change for a $5 bill, you're not on the same planet I'm on.
When you say it doesn't work, what exactly do you mean by that?
Nobody wants them. Canada went to $1 and $2 coins, but they had the sense to stop making the $1 and $2 bills at the same time. And of course, whenever you do a large change like that, people complain about that. People don't like change. But when given no choice, within 6 months or a year or 2 years, and within a generation at least, all the kids are used to it and they stop complaining. But here the government, which is ultimately Congress's decision, has decided to continue making the paper money and to make these stupid dollar coins, and then just complain about the reluctance of the American people to accept these coins that we didn't ask for and that we don't need. But if you have them and you're saving them because you never see them. You think they're special and become valuable someday, and you're wrong. They're making them by the millions and the hundreds of millions, and just spend them, please. If you take them to Walmart or to McDonald's and the teenager says, I can't take these, this isn't money, well, yes, it is, but just take it to your bank. Your bank probably knows what they are, and they'll take them off your hands. What I want to talk about are actual silver dollars. You know, we know that the United States was formed in 1776, and most people are running around looking for coins that go back to 1776 without any notion that when the United States was formed, it was just an afterthought to make coins. At the time, for the first two decades of the United States, foreign coins were in circulation here, mostly Spanish, but also French, and really any kind of coin that we could find that people would accept. The United States didn't start making silver dollar coins until 1794, which is what, 18 years after the Revolution began. They made the flowing hair and the bust dollars from 1794 to 1804. There are several different varieties of these coins, but all of them pretty rare. Look, they didn't make many of them. They didn't do a very good job on these. When you see them, they rarely look perfect, even when they've been well preserved. They just were never very good to begin with. But all of them, unless they're damaged, are worth 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, 7,000, 10,000 and up. Very rare coins, and you just don't see them that often. And then they stopped making silver dollars in 1804 and didn't make them again until like 1840 when they made the seated Liberty dollars. They made seated Liberty dollars from 1840 to 1873. And unless they're damaged, they're worth $200, $300, $400 and up, and can be worth several thousands of dollars. You know, in the wisdom of the Congress and the Mint acting on the direction of the Congress, at some point in the mid-1800s, several different coins were made with the same design, Miss Liberty sitting in a chair. And that included the half dime, the dime, the 20-cent piece, the 25-cent piece, the half dollar, and the silver dollar, all with the same design on them, which is kind of weird. You'd think that we could do better than that, and eventually we did. But then, why did they go from 1804 to 1840, 36 years without a silver dollar? Well, the fact is, Americans never really use those coins. They're big and they're clunky. I mean, if you put a bunch of them in your pocket, and you're not going to want to walk around very much. And not only that, you think about what a dollar was worth way back then. A dollar then is probably worth $50 or more now. I mean, how many $50 bills or $50 coins would you be comfortable walking around with? So these coins really weren't in great demand. And so when we see these older ones, assuming nobody's been mean to them through the years, they're usually in pretty decent shape. You know, there's also the trade dollars that were made from 1873 to 1885, and in Congress's wisdom, it was another version of Liberty seated in a chair. So we had $2 with Liberty seated in a chair at the same time, but these were trade dollars meant for international trade. Imagine that if the United States owed money to England or to China, and there was no credit facility, there was no World Bank, how are we supposed to square up our debts? And if England owed us money, how are they supposed to pay us? Well, they paid us with silver. But what, just silver bars? What's the purity? Well, each country made coins that were considered trade units, and they all had the same standard. And so if we owed you $2 million, we'd give you 2 million of these. And if you owed us $190,000, you'd give us 190,000 of those. And that's how we settled our debts. Most Americans never saw a trade dollar. They did not circulate in the United States. But they're rather interesting, and even a fairly worn example of a trade dollar is going to trade for $90 to $100 and up, up, up. And when I say up and up, any of these coins have the capacity to conceivably trade for hundreds of thousands of dollars, depending on their condition, and I'm going to talk about that in just a moment. Morgan silver dollars were made in 1878, and when Americans think silver dollar, they're thinking Morgan dollar, designed by George Morgan. In 1878, the silver dollars were minted in Philadelphia, San Francisco, New Orleans, and Carson City. Eventually, silver dollars were made in the Denver Mint, too, but the Denver Mint came rather late compared to these other mints. But silver dollars, starting in 1878 in those four cities, Philadelphia, San Francisco, New Orleans, and Carson City, all of them were made out of 90% silver. There's no exception. When they're uncirculated, when they're completely unworn, each one has 0.773 troy ounces. In other words, just over 0.75 ounce of pure silver. And that's actually more silver than you have in 2 half dollars or 4 quarters or 10 dimes. The silver in 2 silver half dollars is the same as the silver in 4 quarters or 10 dimes, but the silver dollars a little bit more, a little superior to that. The circulated common dates of these Morgan dollars, whether they were made in 1878 or up to 1921, or even if you go into the Peace Dollar series that ended in 1935, each one of those, without exception, 0.773 ounces of pure silver, all of them 90% silver, and right now worth about $26 for their silver value. When we or other coin dealers buy them and they're worn, common dates, and undamaged, we'll pay about $2 more than the silver value. So in other words, right now you can sell a common date circulated silver dollar to a willing, knowledgeable party for about $28, and we'll sell them back to you for about $30, because what we make on a silver dollar in small quantities is about $2 a piece. Now, I've been talking about circulated coins, and it's different when a coin is circulated, when it's worn, and when it's uncirculated. When it's uncirculated, it could look pretty good, and a collector might want to go after it and pay more and more for them. You have to understand that these are very heavy coins. That's why people didn't carry them. So a lot of them were put away and not carried, not circulated very heavily, and still look pretty good. People come in all the time with a silver dollar that's still kind of shiny, some mint luster without a lot of wear on it, and they know that that must be evidence that it must be very, very valuable. But most of these coins aren't too worn out, and probably is worth just a little bit more than its $26 base price. But when you get to an uncirculated version, you have to understand it's different now than it was back then. Now, silver dollars are made for collectors, and they're made in clean rooms, and everybody's wearing hair nets, and they're wearing gloves, and they take these very carefully, and they place them into protective capsules. And when you see it, it looks almost perfect, and why shouldn't it? When I see one that doesn't look perfect, I always think, what, did someone drop it and step on it and kick it across the floor? But when you picture a coin factory in 1878, and that's what the mints were, they were coin factories, you had big guys taking these and dumping them in bags and throwing the bag up on a horse cart, and the horse cart rattled all the way to the train station, and they threw the bag on the train, and the train rattled all the way to wherever your bank was. And it was a wonder that any of these coins survived without having marks all over them. And indeed, we see bag marks, B-A-G, bag marks, all over these big silver dollars, where one silver dollar clunked into the other. The trick is not to get a coin with outback marks, because that doesn't exist. The trick is to find a coin with the fewest bag marks possible, and the fewer bag marks, the higher the grade, the more closely it will grade to the perfect theoretical state, MS-70, which really doesn't exist for a Morgan dollar. There is no Morgan dollar that grades MS-70, because that would be a perfect coin. It just doesn't exist. People show us, it's actually the other way around. When we show people silver dollars, very often they say, well, that's not uncirculated, because look, that has a scratch on it, that has a clunk mark on it, a bag mark on it. Well, no, that's what happens to silver dollars. If it's never been in your pocket rattling around and circulating, then it's uncirculated, but it's not going to be perfect. And you can take a coin that, a common date coin that is circulated and worth $28 or so, and get a version of that coin that's not only uncirculated, but has very, very few bag marks on it, and that same coin could be worth 10, 50, conceivably 100,000 or more. Whereas the same coin circulated, the kind you probably have in your sock drawer, if you're lucky enough to have a Morgan dollar, would be worth about $28. Also, when we talk about these coins, we talk about whether they're circulated or uncirculated, or whether they're common dates or uncommon dates. A common date, what's the common date? Well, we always refer to in the money facts of life number 10, the definition of rare is you don't have it. If you have it, it is probably a common date, because the uncommon dates were plucked out of circulation and saved by collectors, and frankly, not many of them were put into circulation in the first place.
1921 Morgan.
Yeah, 1921 Morgan. I mean, the 1921 Morgan was so widely manufactured that when people bring us 10 silver dollars, I'm willing to bet you a fair number of them, maybe a majority of them, will be the 1921s. What are the exceptions to the common dates? Carson City, you've heard us talk about it before. It's a little branch mint in Carson City, Nevada. They made very few coins. All of the Carson City silver dollars, even worn out, unless you got a bullet hole right through it, are going to be worth more than any of the other worn out common dates. Also, the silver dollars from the 1890s tend to be worth more than other dates. It's not a matter of age. It's just that during the 1890s, the United States experienced a severe depression. Several times in U.S. history, we've had severe depressions, and it's evidenced by our coinage. In the mid-1830s, there was a banking crisis. During the Civil War, we couldn't make coins. The Depression of the 1890s, the Depression of 1929, we couldn't make coins. And possibly coming soon to a theater near you, maybe we can't make coins in the near future either. But all I know is that the United States has always come back from this, has always come back. And I'm going to bet that we come back again. In 1904, the United States made the last Morgan silver dollars, and then they stopped. Until 1921, and they came back with a vengeance. Check your Morgan dollars. They're probably dated 1921. But if they're not, they're probably dated, well, they're probably not Morgans. They're probably peace dollars and dated 1922, 23, 24, 25. These are the common dates in the peace dollars, celebrating the peace after World War I that ended in 1918. The peace dollars are made from 1921 through 1935. The 1921 Morgan, as common as dirt. The 1921 peace dollar, one of the rare coins of the series. But if you have a 1921 dollar, it's either the old-style Morgan or the new-style peace dollar. Peace dollar better, the Morgan dollar, very, very common. And there are varieties of the 1921 peace dollar, too. But most peace dollars from 1922 to 28 circulated will be that $28 variety that you can expect to sell for $28 and buy more of for about $30, except the 1928 Philadelphia. And how do you know whether it's a P or whether it's made in Denver or San Francisco? Well, you can read a book, look it up on the internet, or you know what? You can even bring them to somebody like us at the Jewelry Exchange. Bring them to any coin dealer. Any coin dealer I know will be happy to show you how to tell what you have, and even to make you an offer if you want to. The mint stopped making silver dollars in 1928, didn't start again until 1934, because really there was never much of a demand for this coin. Big and clunky and worth more than most people wanted to carry around with them. So they started making them again in 1934 and in 1935. Both of those years even circulated circulated are a little more valuable than the common date circulated coins. But any of these peace dollars, even the very common 1922s, 23s, 24s, 25s, uncirculated, can go $35, $40, $45, $50, and on up. And I always mean and up, because any of these could be worth thousands of dollars, but probably not the ones you have. So we always ask people to be optimistic, but you got to get real too. Be careful when you look up the values of your coins, because unless you're grading them accurately, you don't have a prayer. It takes years. You can't become a grading expert overnight. That's why you need to bring them to us at the Jewelry Exchange, bring them to a coin dealer, ask their opinion, and anyone who's treating you right and honestly is going to give you the same information. There will be no charge for looking at them. The estimates of their value free. There's no obligation to do all that. So please come and see us or any reputable coin dealer. We'd love to share our hobby and our business with you. That music means that we're up against a hard break. KLUP is about to take you away, but we're not going anywhere. We'll be right back with Janet Wisenhunt of Charlotte's Antiques for the Great Estate Debate. Don't go away. You're listening to In the Money with David and Adam Bluestein from the Jewelry Exchange and Auction. You're back with David and Adam Bluestein from the Jewelry Exchange and Auction on In the Money, the show that answers the questions, what is it, what's it worth, and what do I do with it? Our guest today is our friend Janet Wisenhunt from Charlotte's Antiques on Austin Highway, San Antonio's oldest and most trusted antique dealership. Welcome back, Janet. Thanks for joining us again on In the Money.
Thanks. Good to be back.
Hey, how's your mother?
She's doing good. She's at work every day.
Please tell everybody who's listening who your mother is.
Charlotte Wisenhunt with Charlotte's Antiques. She's been there for 46 years.
Yeah, we describe her as San Antonio's oldest antique dealer because she opened the doors right after the Civil War ended, right?
Right.
Yeah. And she's never going to come on this show, is she?
No.
I would love to get her on here. You know, she's... I see her as the Iron Lady at the front door of that building year after year. Nothing gets past her. I think she would tackle somebody who was trying to pull something off, but we can't get her on the show.
No, sorry about that.
She
would love to come, though, but she would just wouldn't be comfortable.
tell us all about Charlotte's Antiques.
Well, we're located on Austin Highway at 2023 Austin Highway. We've been there since 1966. It's a family-owned business. One of the largest probably in South Texas, and have probably a little variety of everything to offer to anybody. If you'd like to find out more about us, you can go to charlottesantiques.com. That's Charlotte's without an E.
And you keep regular hours, correct?
Yes, we're open Tuesday through Saturday, 10 to 5.
You might have some specialties. I know you're an all-purpose antique dealer, but I think you have some specialties, no?
Right. Well, traditionally, we were always specialized in clocks, and we still love clocks. But we have a large selection of china. My mother's love has always been Hummels, although they're not the most popular thing anymore. Deal in a lot of costume jewelry, vintage clothes, books, pictures, just about everything.
But there's another side to your business other than the retail antique shop, correct? The estate sales.
Right.
And how does that work? I mean, what is an estate sale?
Well, estate sale, traditionally what you would define is when a liquidator would go in and hold a sale in a home and liquidate the contents, whether it be because somebody is moving, deceased, or whatever reason they need to empty the contents of the home.
Yeah, we hear the term downsizing several times a day now.
Right, especially as people are living longer and going into retirement communities. They'll downsize, and then they don't know what to do with the remainder of their property, so they'll call in a liquidator.
And how do these people find you, or how do you find them?
Well, you can find liquidators through the, you know, Google them or in the Yellow Pages. Most of ours are referral because we've been around so long and had so many estate sales that somebody will know somebody and they'll refer us to us.
People know that you're doing this. What exactly are the services that you offer to these people?
Well, I'll be a little bit more general. There's really typically two ways that an estate sale is handled. The first one would be where the liquidator would come in and they would charge you a percent of what they sold. So they're going to charge 20-30% of the asking price plus possibly their expenses and advertising and other miscellaneous things. The second way, and this is the way that Charlotte's does it, is we go in and inventory the entire household, come up with the price that we feel like is fair, where we'll make a fair profit, pay our expenses, and we will just write the check up front.
So you just buy the merchandise from the homeowner.
We buy it.
And then you move it out, or you stage a sale out on the premises?
We almost always will have the sale on the premises. Sometimes we move it out, but we prefer not to just because of the cost of moving.
Now, during the intro, I mean, you were sitting here, you heard what we said. We said an estate sale is where gawking strangers wander through your house and haggle over your treasures. Would you care to rebut?
I think that's a very good description, actually.
When somebody calls you and says that they want to have an estate sale, approximately how long does that take?
Well, of course, a lot has to do with your schedule, but if it was in the ideal world, we could go out and inventory the estate, write them a check, and if all the timing was right, have it finished within 2 weeks.
Okay.
And if someone said, look, I appreciate your offer, but I want to roll the dice here and see if we can get the public to pay higher and higher prices, would you do it for a percentage? Would you do it on spec, kind of like that?
We will, but we really prefer
the... It's not the way you want to do that.
Yeah.
Now, I know that you have a... you have a storefront next to your main store, and that I know at least on one occasion you've actually restaged the estate in that it's kind of like a house or an office.
Right.
It could be used as a retail space, and you've restaged it there. How did that work?
Well, it works great, except for the expense of moving. You're basically packing up the entire contents of a house and moving it into another house and having to unpack it. And just because of the nature of it, the seller is paying that cost because it's an additional cost to the liquidator.
Yeah, I know your mother enjoys when I use the word schlepping because of her German roots and my family's Yiddish roots. Boy, you know, you schlep that stuff from here to here, and
right.
Sooner or later you say, just take it. I don't want to schlep
right,
it anymore.
Right.
If there are some negative aspects to the estate sale, I mean, strangers come into your house, right?
Right.
And you ask them a price, and do they usually say okay, or do they want to haggle?
Well, the way we do it, and I haven't visited that many other estates because we're so busy, but traditionally we have every item in the store priced, or we have a sign that says, for instance, books $4 or something like that when it's bulk. The first day would be full price, the second day would be 20% off, and the third day would be 50% off. About 4:30 on the third day, it's offer me a price.
Make me an offer.
But we do not come down. It's a set price, and we've always just held firm to it and followed the percentage. And the reason is that if somebody comes in and they know that we'll come down and they ask us for a discount and we give it to them, but then the next person doesn't do that, we just don't feel like it's fair. You know, we feel like we should be fair to all the customers that come in, whether they know the system or not.
It's sort of like a reverse auction, but it happens on a timetable.
Right.
And the person who wants to wait and take a chance they can get that discount, they also take the chance that somebody takes it before
they get
to it. So there's always some psychology involved in this. Well, if there's a negative aspect to the estate sale, with the strangers come in and all the haggling, tell us something positive about people who decide to do estate sales. What are the benefits to them of doing that?
Well, I think there's a lot. First of all, the person who's the owner of the merchandise or the home, or a lot of times the heir that's handling the estate, they just don't have to deal with it. They don't have to go through everything and, you know, throw the magazines here or give the clothes to Goodwill. You can just pretty much take out everything you want or what the family wants, walk away, and then have a sale, and when you come back, it should all be gone.
Well, you know, we're in the auction business. That's no surprise to you. And, you know, we're talking about the differences between the estate sales and what happens at an auction when somebody has a bunch of merchandise that they want to sell. We don't do heavier merchandise at the Jewelry Exchange. I know you do a lot of furniture and household effects. And there are some people in town. We know Billy Ward, who's a friend of our company, who's down on Bandera, mm-hmm. and he'll do all sorts of household effects. And we know Gene Vogt at Vogt Auctions on Boardwalk off of Broadway, and Gene specializes in furniture. He does a lot of European furniture that he brings in from Europe and a bunch of other local merchandise. Mm-hmm. What are the differences in your mind why someone should go the estate sale route rather than the auction route?
Well, I think the nice thing, like I said, with the estate is that you walk out and when you come back, it's all gone. So everything has sold. Now, I will say that there is somewhat of a variation if you do it as a percent. Typically, they don't empty the house at the end. So you may come back to all the junk left, too, versus when we buy it. Since we own everything in the building, at the end of the estate, if it's not sold, we either give it away to a charity, sell it to a person, or, you know, we will dispose of it. So when you do come back, the house is empty.
Yeah, I think that, I know that we've worked liquidating households with Billy Ward from Ward Auction. And Billy will come and he'll do the schlepping for us. We don't like to do the schlepping. We like to employ young ladies who carry a piece of jewelry or a coin on a tray, and that's about as sweaty as we want to see our people getting. I guess there doesn't have to be schlepping for the owner, but at some point the merchandise does have to be packed up, and to what degree does the homeowner have input into what you're asking for this merchandise?
Well, for us, they have no input because we own it. So
you bought that outright.
Right. So if we think it's worth a dollar and they think it's worth $100, it doesn't matter. They've already got their money.
I see.
Versus somebody, and that can be an issue, somebody who does it as a percent. If the homeowners or the relatives come back in, it's not so much what it's worth, it's sentimental. So if they see something that grandmother had, in their eyes, it's worth a lot of money, but it's really more emotional money,
right,
versus realistically worth.
Does it ever happen that somebody buys some of their own merchandise back because they would rather own it than see you sell it at a price?
Yes.
It does?
Yes.
Well, tell me about that.
Well,
you're smiling like you have a story.
Well, I think that the story is probably a little somewhat different, but what we find a lot is when families squabble, and so they have to sell everything just to get rid of it, and so then they come back in, and basically they're buying back their stuff because nobody could get along.
Well, we have similar situations, too, where in order to make an equitable distribution of the whole pot, the whole body of merchandise, that it has to be sold and the people can get the money. And if they want, they can come back as private individuals,
right,
and just buy merchandise back. And in this case, you're describing a situation where the people have a set amount. They can't get less. They can't get more. And at the auction, we know that, you know, when we take a household full of merchandise, some sale prices at the end of the auction are going to just disappoint the owners, and maybe to the point where they feel sick or even angry. But some of the prices will go higher than anyone could have imagined. And although the nature of people is to focus on the stuff they're disappointed about, we have to remind them about the merchandise that they got a lot more than they thought they were going to get for it. At the auction, I mean, just anything can happen, and boy, anything does happen. Do you ever run into merchandise in an estate that you just don't understand?
Oh, sure. I mean,
and how do you do? What do you do?
Well, we research it, and sometimes we'll call in people we know and ask their opinions. But if it's something that your gut's saying this is better than, you know, just a normal item, we will definitely research it.
How do you come up with your prices then? Is a lot of it just by your gut or your experience?
It is. It's mostly by experience and what sells. Now with the fluctuating market and with eBay and other things like that, there's a lot of times that I just have to go on and see what the market's paying, because especially in some areas, it's gone down so rapidly that you just have to go and double check yourself sometimes.
Yeah. We all the time have to adjust our heads,
right,
because
right.
We think of some things as worth X amount of dollars, And it's changing constantly. You have to constantly right. be adjusting.
Be recalibrating
our
mm-hmm. your perception. You know, people come into our gallery all the time and have misconceptions of what things are worth. And they also come in and they bring us merchandise they've bought at estate sales. And very often it's merchandise. Well, you know, I was about to say something that isn't fair, because people will bring us merchandise they bought in an estate sale, and it's obvious to us, being specialists on in certain areas, that it just sold way too cheaply. But then again, people will buy things at our auctions and then find somebody else somewhere who wants to pay them a lot more for it, and they'll come in and brag about that. And I guess that's happening in all the venues. I guess
right.
I'm supposed to be defending auction against estate sale, but I guess I've seen it both ways, where people have just gotten tremendous deals, and because I guess they were the ones in the room who understood it, and maybe nobody else did.
Right.
I know Adam was invited to a jewelry sale, a jewelry estate sale, and at the door, they gave all the potential buyers a little basket. And I don't know, were there other things in the sale besides jewelry?
There was costume jewelry and furniture and other personal effects, but they had the majority of it were tables set up with mostly gold and silver jewelry, and there were other things like costume jewelry, but all the gold, they had separated the gold and silver to be on one table, and the costume jewelry was on another table in another room.
Did they do a good job at the separation?
No, not really. And so what I ended up doing was I brought a scale. And I wasn't shy about it. I brought out my scale and started putting things on the scale. And when I realized what formula they had used, I basically just took my arm and swept everything.
Took it all.
off the table into the basket. Then I went over to the costume jewelry and I found big, heavy silver pieces in there priced for nothing.
I know that.
So they said that they were actually happy. The people that put on the sale, they said they were happy I came, because I created a real frenzy, and that
when everybody
saw me grabbing things, and other people started grabbing things, and it just became a madhouse.
But you grabbed the good stuff.
Yeah.
That was the difference.
That's right.
So knowledge always helps.
Yeah, specialized knowledge. We've preached that on this program so often. We have so many people coming to our sales who are trying to get some of everything, and we're saying, why don't you become a specialist in a certain
right.
area and know more than anybody else in the room about that? And then you know exactly what you're doing. A gentleman brought me two blue albums, each album full of round white metal discs that he had bought at an estate sale for $100 for the two albums. And you know, it took me about a half a second to determine that those discs with the president's pictures on them mm-hmm. Were sterling silver discs from the Franklin Mint, and I gave him $1,700, and I made a couple $100 on it too.
Right, right.
And so that has been my pet peeve against people who put on estate sales, that if they don't know what they're doing, they're going to cost the homeowners some serious money by giving away merchandise.
Right, and
like
you hear that all the time.
Yeah, I mean, you just have to know.
Right.
And we hear it the other way too, where recently there was an estate sale that included a lot of gold coins, and I saw the asking prices. They published this, and the asking prices for the gold coins, and each gold coin several hundred dollars above what they could have bought them for from any coin dealer or bullion dealer, including us. And the people that I know who went to the sale said they sold them all. People were there just paying way too much right. for really common merchandise.
Very often I see that those aren't even really part of the estate. Sometimes they'll even have different dealers show up and put their own merchandise in,
right.
in as if it was part of the estate.
Oh, that's true. Kind
right.
of like salting the mine, right?
Yeah.
What types of merchandise are most appropriate for this, for the sales that you do, and what's least appropriate for the sales?
Well, for the estate sale, we basically just buy the entire content. We tell people not to take anything out. Typically, they throw away the things that people might want. Maybe they're not even worth that much, but we just tell them to take what they want and leave the rest, and we'll sort through it. We'll figure out what the trash is.
And not clean anything?
No, because we can do that too. I mean, unless it's just really, really filthy, but we'll bring in crew to do that.
Well, but people call us to their homes sometimes to consider whether we want to auction off their merchandise. Mm-hmm. I say the vast majority of estates we go to look at, we don't even really want to handle. We're looking and saying, I don't think there's anything here people compete for. So certainly you must turn down some states.
Oh, no, we turn down quite a few. We prefer to do about 6 to 8 big estates a year rather than doing the nickel and dime ones. I won't even consider it. I mean, if there's not at least, and it doesn't sound like a lot, but typically most houses won't even have this much, but if it doesn't have at least $10,000 worth, it's not worth our time.
And so your experience, it sounds like our experience too. You know, we say it here too, our in the money facts of life, number one, nobody wants your smelly old junk.
Right.
And, you know, I think of the three, I hear this all the time, and I'm sure you do too. Someone has a sofa, they paid $3,000 for the sofa, and it's still in excellent condition, and so they just can't believe you can't get more than $100 or $200 for
it. If you're
lucky. But, right? Am I right? Ladies and gentlemen, nobody wants your smelly old sofa. Anybody who had the money to pay $1,500 for a sofa isn't going to buy a used sofa.
Right.
Especially if it has cat hair all over.
Especially. They're not going to do that. So All your only hope is to find someone who can't afford a $3,000 sofa, who's willing to pay $100 or $200 and schlep it away for you.
Exactly.
You know, we handle pool tables, for example, and half the time you got to pay someone just to take the pool table away. The homeowner has to move, and everyone thinks the pool table will cost me $1,500, $3,000, $5,000, but moving it. And when we take apart retail situations where they have safes, try to find someone to pay more than a couple hundred dollars for a safe. They always say, we have to move it.
Right.
So
right.
You just can't get much for it. And when it's all said and done, what do? Call Salvation Army?
Well, we like to give a lot of ours to the Veterans Association. They have a little thrift store, so we donate that, a lot of the remains to them. Or if there's somebody, you know, that we find that just wants to come in and say, we'll give you X amount of dollars for everything left. Well, sometimes we'll do that. We do whatever we have to so that that house is empty when we leave.
Yeah, we try to find the merchandise the people will compete for, and if they won't, then we suggest an estate sale or a garage sale.
Right.
And half the time we're saying maybe you just want to call Goodwill or the Salvation
right.
Army and save yourself all the heartache. So the correct answer might be a combination of both. You just have to look and decide on the quality of the merchandise.
Yes.
But in most cases, the estate probably isn't worth an estate sale, probably isn't worth an auction, and should just be distributed some way, one way or another. If someone wants to contact you, how can they do that, Janet?
You can reach Charlotte's at 210-653-3672 or go to our webpage, Charlotte's Antiques, without an E. CharlottesAntiques.com, and that should give you all the information you need.
And it's free to talk to you, right?
Yes, come by and see us.
We're going to take a short commercial break, then we'll return to open up the phone lines here on In the Money with our special guest, Janet Weissenhunt from Charlotte's Antiques, and Adam and me, David Bluestein from the Jewelry Exchange and Auction. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Adam from the Jewelry Exchange and Auction in San Antonio, introducing our weekday James Avery Auctions with 1,000 pieces of estate James Avery jewelry sold to the highest bidder with no minimums or reserves. New and retired designs at up to 80%. Off. This is a perfect opportunity to stock up on hard-to-find pieces. It's easy to register and bid online right now at jewelryexchangeandauction.com. Auctions start every Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday evening at 7 o'clock. Also join us each Saturday at 7 p.m. for our live auctions in Stone Oak, featuring even more designer jewelry from Rolex, Tiffany, Pandora, John Hardy, David Yurman, and more, all guaranteed to be authentic. It's all happening at the Jewelry Exchange and Auction, Texas license number 16604, member Better Business Bureau. Visit jewelryexchangeandauction.com and join us every Saturday morning at 7 a.m. for In the Money right here on KLUP. James Avery is a registered trademark of James Avery Craftsman Incorporated.
You're back with David and Adam Bluestein from the Jewelry Exchange and Auction on In the Money, the show that answers the questions, what is it, what's it worth, and what do I do with it? Our guests today are friend Janet Weissenhunt from Charlotte's Antiques on Austin Highway in San Antonio, San Antonio's oldest and most trusted antique dealership. Adam, I think you have some questions for Janet from some emailers.
Well, actually, I'm not so sure that they're up Janet's alley, but these are some emails that we've gotten. Some
well, we
email
tell
questions
people we'll take all your questions.
I have an email from Martha. It says, "We are looking to sell our rifle and shotgun. They are in mint condition. Is this something you would buy?" Well, I'm going to answer that question.
Yeah, Adam's our gun guy.
We have an FFL, a federal firearms license from the ATF, and so we are legally allowed to buy any kind of firearm, although typically the way we would prefer to handle that is to take it on consignment for auction. If you're not in a hurry to cash out of it today, then you're going to do better that way. Firearms are very hot at auction. And rather than purchase them from you, we'd rather take them on consignment.
And tell me, Janet, when you're doing an estate sale, are you allowed to handle firearms in that way?
We usually do not purchase them.
You don't purchase them?
Mm-mm.
But if you were working on a commission, could you sell them for people?
Mm-mm.
I don't know how the law applies to that.
I don't think we could legally, but we would not do it.
Wouldn't do it anyway.
Mm-mm. We're just not knowledgeable. I would rather send them to you or to somebody who has the knowledge.
But firearms are really hot. We want everybody's firearms, no matter what they are. We want to put them into the auction.
You have another question, Adam?
Yes, I do. Roger asks, what would you pay for an 1884S Morgan Silver Dollar graded
yes.
MS-65?
What a great example. We sold an 1884S, I think, last Saturday night. Maybe a couple hundred dollars, I can't remember. And then an MS-65. I mean, an MS-65, which is five notches short of perfect, is probably a $100,000 coin.
Closer to two,
maybe $200,000 coin. And it's MS-65, Mint State 65, says who? There are some grading services that have the reliability credibility in the marketplace to make that statement. Almost no other service or no individual could state it as an MS-65 and bring that kind of money. The grading is so important, and as I said, you can't learn that in a weekend. That's a lifelong pursuit. Talk to a qualified dealer or show it to us and let us give you a real answer. Are we out of time already?
Yes.
Boy, this is the shortest hour on radio. Our thanks again to Janet Weissenhunt from Charlotte's for joining us here today. We'll be back next Saturday at 7 o'clock with our new program, Plata de México, Mexican Silver, with our friend Ernie Martin. If you have questions about anything, coins, estate merchandise, the meaning of life, give us a call at 210-592-8786 or email questions@inthemoneyradio.com. We hope to see you all tonight at our live auction at the Jewelry Exchange in Stone Oak, and we hope you'll join us again next week here for In the Money, the show that answers the questions, what is it, what's it worth, and what do I do with it? Thanks for joining us this morning, and everybody, please have a great week.